everyone, and welcome to Teen Connect on WDIY 88.1. I'm your host, Helen Cox. Here on Teen Connect, we spotlight the voices and stories shaping our generation and create conversations that bring together experts and teens to better understand our world and the role we each play in shaping it. As always, our audio editing is handled by James Ziprote. On Teen Connect, we focus on the voices and stories shaping our generation. And so we're thrilled to welcome today's honorable guest, the artistic director of the Bachman Players, Christopher Black. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So let's start from the beginning. Could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I think I can put that in a fairly concise little story. So I've had a lot of professional acting experience, and it sort of came about like this, and we might talk in more detail, but hooked up in high school. And, you know, it gave me a lot of agency and control over my life and the things that I was doing and a lot of satisfaction. And then I wanted to continue to pursue that and to get more of that. So I studied acting in college, went to the National Shakespeare Conservatory. When I was in college, and I went to Bennington College, they sent us abroad, as a lot of colleges do with theater students, but we saw a lot of stuff by the Royal Shakespeare Company, saw both in Stratford and in London. And at the time, the shows that did well in Stratford would then go on to London. So in a year or one season, you could see shows in both places. And we got to meet some of the actors and directors and that kind of thing. And if people aren't familiar, the Royal Shakespeare Company does a thing that's sort of like repertory theater where you use some of the same actors in different plays. And I would watch that, and I'd even come in and have my dinner in the theater, and I'd watch them change over the sets. I was like, oh, wow, that's amazing. I really want to do something like that. Like, imagine being in more than one play at the same time. So when I ended up at the National Shakespeare Conservatory, a two-year acting program, it turned out that they had an internship program with a company called the Jean Cocteau Repertory, which was one of the only repertory companies in the country that did that year-round.
Oh, wow.
So I sort of ended up in a company, and in a lot of ways was better than the Royal Shakespeare Company. Not that the quality is better. Quality is very good. But the Cocteau was 10, 12, 15 actors. So if you're doing five or six plays in a season, you really do see the same actors in the different plays. And I would be as many as, you know, two to four plays at one time. And I did that for 12 years. That got me about 1,200 live performances at the very least.
Oh, my gosh.
So there are not a lot of people walking around the street that, you know, have that kind of experience. And this is all classical stage experience. You know, Shakespeare, the Greeks, George Shaw, Chekhov, et cetera, et cetera. So what I sort of set out for as a young person to say, I want to encounter this to give myself agency and control over my life to do things. Providence and perseverance carried me through to the point where I had so much of that after 12 years. I said, you know, I might like to go out on a date or, you know, have a house or do some things like that. And then I eventually left. I met my wife in Brooklyn. We moved from New York City to the Lehigh Valley. And I kind of, because I have a second job we will talk about a little bit, my real job. But after a few years of kind of being quiet with all that creative work, it kind of crept back. People heard about what I had done and put opportunities in front of me that I then developed into the Bachman Players, which is a 10 or 12 or 13-year-old project at this point.
Cool. Annette, were you ever in a production of Julius Caesar? I've just finished reading it for my English class, the play.
I was never in a production of Julius Caesar. We studied it a lot, and a lot of people do monologues from it. I think I did an audition monologue from it, but I haven't. But it's one of, most all of Shakespeare's stuff is pretty wonderful.
Yes. And I know you mentioned high school, but was there a moment or something that initially inspired you to get into acting?
Yeah and no. The funny thing is, and I think this is transferable to sort of anything that you get that sparks you, that you get interested in. When I was in high school, there was a cute girl that I liked, and we were friends, and she wanted me to go to auditions with her to help give her moral support. Didn't really have much interest myself, but to sort of be in the room, it was necessary for me to get up and do a little bit. And the drama coach teacher, who also taught English, his name was Michael Burgoyne, and he was definitely an early influence on me, and he saw something in me and got me hooked right into the plays and found things that I could do that would engage me. And it probably took me a solid year to really fall in love with it. We were doing The Hobbit, which was my very favorite story of all time. And he double cast the role of Gollum so that I could play it. And I was 15 at the time. Mm. And that was really super. And that from then, I was pretty hooked. And I never, except for that maybe, you know, year and a half to 2 years when I first moved to the Lehigh Valley and I kind of focused on other things, I've been doing it ever since.
So that segues into the next question. What drew you specifically to the Lehigh Valley, if anything?
I would say Easton. And actually now, you know, I do a lot of history work, and we can talk about that and sort of as that comes up. But it was really the practicality. My wife, Patricia, is an artist. She does Pasanke eggs. She does fine art painting. Easton had a very pretty lively downtown arts community. At the time, I was still working in New York City, so I needed to be able to get into New York City. You could take Transbridge and go in and go out. And it seemed like the right balance of, you know, rivers and little mountains, but a nice little town and access to the city. So those were, it was the practical things really, but with this sort of veneer of it being a creative, because you met a lot of people that used to be in Brooklyn, used to be in New York City, and it had a little bit of a vibe of those intense metropolises, but it was sort of easier to get things done and more relaxed.
It's like a little arts hub.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Like a local one.
Yeah.
And then how did you get involved with the Bachman Players?
Well, I created it, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's very funny to me. My wife and I joke, and people say, oh, are you with the Bachman Players? I say, well, because in a lot of ways, I mean, we've had, you know, probably 20 to 35 people come through, like, the 12-year project. I have some people that started with me right 12 years ago and are still with me. I have a rehearsal on Sunday with two of my actors that were in my very first plays. But it started pretty... Simply to explain it, I made some friends that were associated with the Sigel Museum, and the Sigel Museum was running the Bachman Tavern, the 1753 public house downtown in Easton. That's open 4 days a week, public, you know, plug for it. You can go see it. It's the oldest town in Easton, 1753, I think it was built. And they had learned that John Adams had come and dined there. And in his diary, it said, you know, I dined in Easton, Shannon's at the Forks, he called it in Easton. Said, could you do something? And I said, well, sure, okay. And I thought about it. I said, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to sit in a corner with a sign that says I'm John Adams? I mean, what am I going to do? So I realized it needed to be a bit of a play. And the fortunate thing about the Adamses, Abigail and John, is they were apart so long, not fortunate for them, but they were apart so long that they wrote probably hundreds of letters. Mm. And for me, getting into history... Letters, personal letters, are an absolute goldmine, because if you read enough, because I'm sure I've read hundreds of Adams's letters, and you read someone's personal sentiments, not what a biographer said about them, okay? What fascinates me about history is there's so much primary material. You can read newspapers, you can read letters. You know, it's fine to read, you know, biographies, but you can read what they actually said. So I read hundreds of Adams' letters and felt like I began to understand what he wanted, was about, what was important to him, and then put together this play at the Bachman that recreated him having dinner. And then that was the idea of using historical settings to create characters. And you've encountered my Benjamin Franklin,
yes.
Right? Creating historical characters with such depth that you hopefully leave the people with a bit of a feeling that they've actually met that person.
Oh, definitely.
So thank you. And so if you're in historic setting, it even just, it amps it all up. So we did the John Adams play for the Sigel and the Bachman, and then I started to do Benjamin Franklin plays. And I've written five or six plays like that that I do in little bits. But yeah.
Cool. Were you interested in history, like, growing up, or was that kind of
I was not. I was not. And, you know, I think I can explain that fairly simply, too. It was like this. Now, I don't know, you know, the age of your audience, but hopefully they're younger than I am. But when I got into my 30s, having had really a lot of success with what I wanted to do creatively, I began to ask the question a little bit, like, well, what's it kind of all about? Like, why am I getting out of bed? What's the universe? What does it mean? What's going on here with this whole
everyday thoughts?
Everyday,
yep.
You know. So I thought, well, what makes people people? I said, well, I think art kind of makes people people. Creativity, that's the big difference between us and, you know, everything else. And so then I looked at that, and I looked at Leonardo da Vinci, and I looked at Benjamin Franklin. I said, here are two really interesting people that if I want to get some clues about what is it all about, I could learn more about them. And I'm still fascinated by da Vinci, but I don't know that I'd want to be him. He was a little bit dark and had a little bit of, granted he lived in a harder, I mean, Franklin lived in a very difficult time, but da Vinci lived in a harder time. And Franklin always had a little gleam in his eye and sort of looked like he ate the canary somehow and did so much good for the world and enjoyed himself at the same time. I said, I want to learn more about him. And to learn more about him, you have to learn more about the time that he was in. So he was actually my door into history. The Adams, you know, I needed to learn because I needed a particular character, but I had begun to learn about the 1700s through Benjamin Franklin and then remain absolutely fascinated with it.
So I know you just mentioned Benjamin Franklin and also John Adams. What would you say the process looks like for you in terms of researching and getting into character for a historical figure?
Well, it is, you know, as I was kind of noting before, you're spoiled with history because the difference between history and a play, generally speaking, when you've got a play, you often have one piece to work with. You've got one play in front of you. You've got one Chekhov play. You've got one Greek tragedy. You've got, you know, the context of these pages in front of you for this one piece to understand how you're going to portray a character and what it's going to mean and how he would think and act. When you're recreating a historical figure, you have hundreds of resources, hundreds, you know. I will just give you an example that I've worked into some of my plays because I focus with Benjamin Franklin, what he's doing at my age. Right now, he's very proud of his son, William, who just became governor of New Jersey. So when I do a little piece or I meet people, I will often mention, you know, that if they live in New Jersey, how fortunate they are that, you know, William is now their governor and how great he is. So for what I do now, it's the newspapers of the day and the letters that they write to understand what they really mean and intend. Now, when you're working in a play, it isn't different in the sense that you still want to understand what drives the character, the person, because we're all human and people always do what they think is best for them or what they think is best for someone else. No one does an evil thing to be an evil person. Somehow, some way, they think that it is either going to help them or they think it's going to help someone else. And you need to find that motivation in the character. But I find that to be a lot easier if you have hundreds of letters and resources about the person, as opposed to having just one, you know, play that is maybe 2 hours long where you have to pull everything you want to find about that character out of that one piece.
So it's like you take a bunch of different resources and then kind of find your...
You find the person. You find the person. You understand, you know, what was important to John Adams. He loved his horse, for example. Like he would, when he would travel, I'm actually from Maine originally. And when he was doing the lawyer circuit, he would travel up to Scarborough and Portland. And every time he put his horse away, he'd say, you know, that he petted her. And he rode these donkeys in Spain. And he was like, he wrote how great the donkeys were. That he's warm, you know, but then was so passionate about liberty and find out where he got those ideas. So, you know, you understand what the person wants. And once you understand what they want, then speaking like them doesn't seem to be difficult.
So is most of it like pre-written then, kind of? Or you just like know them so well that you're able to come up?
Well, I know that, well, it's different. Like with Adams, I almost always have to write a script if I'm going to present. With Franklin, I can just go off the cuff and I know what he thinks about so many things. That I can sort of just talk. So the improvisation is more if you really know the character. If I know the character, it's less because I do. Again, I write almost all my own material. I mean, well, I say I write it. Well, really, they write it. What I try to do is say that my scripts and my material are like 75% original documents because nothing can be better than saying what they actually said. And if you know them well enough, you can say, oh, I know a letter where John Adams talks about this, or I know a letter where Franklin mentions this, and let me quote that as much as I possibly can. Then you know you're hearing their voice.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for engaging in this conversation so far. You're listening to Teen Connect here on WDIY with our guest, Christopher Black. We're going to take a short break, but don't go anywhere because we'll be right back.
WDIY's overnight delivery service is a refreshing mix of vintage and current popular music. You'll hear many of the artists played on The Blend and some from our folk, blues, and world programs. WDIY Overnight is a continuous mix of music popular with night owls and late shift workers. Listen Monday through Saturday night from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. and Sundays from midnight to 5 a.m. for this great mix of hand-picked music on WDIY.
Welcome back to Teen Connect. Today we are discussing the world of history and acting with Christopher Black. So to jump back into it, do you have any words of advice for upcoming or current teens within the industry today?
Well, when I say industry, I'm going to presume you're sort of talking about acting in the general sense.
Yeah.
I do. You know, and actually it's funny, the Franklin piece that I'm doing that we're doing in Hellertown, so we'll make a plug later for that, you know, talks about finding your own sort of light. He says how much he likes to give advice. He says, I like to give advice. I don't like to get advice, but I like to give advice. And I would say the National Shakespeare Conservatory, you know, I maybe had 20 people in my class, and most of them didn't go on to do it for very, very long. And I always thought that was because they weren't successfully finding the joy of the process, okay? So, you know, for me, art, and I think this is really true of anything, but the journey itself has to have great value and integrity and be something and give something to you. It can't be a stored up place that you assume you're going to get to or achieve at a later time. It's fine to have goals, but to spend, you know, a period of time sort of suffering or being discontent because you're not at a place is very different than saying or finding a way to enjoy what you do, whatever that thing is, whether it's a class, whether it's reading plays, whether it's interacting with friends, whether it's how you look at movies, but to find a way that gives you satisfaction and improves your life on a regular basis, rather than saying, when I get to this mark, then I'm going to be happy. If you're not happy along the way, then that's a long row to hoe, and I think there's going to be a lot less joy in it.
I would agree. On a similar note, do you have any regrets or mistakes to avoid that you would like to share with teenagers pursuing their passion, whatever it may be, today?
I think I maybe actually just said it, you know, that it has to serve you, and then it's the right thing.
What is something you hope to see more of within the acting industry in the future?
Well, this isn't exactly an answer to that question, because I think it's fine. You know, I think I actually had been so busy with what I was doing that I hadn't reached out to look at some other community theaters, and I've started to see other theater here in the Lehigh Valley, which I've been kind of pleased with. But, you know, one thing that I'm a little sad about is in a lot of cases, there is a lot of amplification, which is hard for a classical actor brought up old school. You know, you go to a high school play and often there's sort of so many microphones that, you know, sort of projection and understanding what's happening on the stage with the audio is a little less intuitive than it used to be. So I understand it's practical and necessity, but so you're asking me what I'd like to see more of, and mm-hmm. I'm kind of saying what I'd sort of like to see less of, which is,
no problem.
That's kind of my response, so I feel like a pooper, but that's what I say.
What would you say are the most rewarding parts of your careers? You said you have two.
For my real job, I run the technology. I'm the vice president of technology for a photo agency called the Everett Collection. Which was in New York, and they allowed me a part-time schedule, which allowed me to do the shows I needed to do, because at the Cocteau, you would sometimes have performances and rehearsals during the weekday. But I think the most satisfying thing, and this is more about the Bachman Players, because when I was so busy as an actor in an off-Broadway theater, it was lovely to do the creative work and know that you affected the audiences. But when you create environments for people to participate in, so when I do a piece with the Bachman Players, you know, I'll have 6 or 8 or 10 of my own people participate in the experience, and they learn the lines and they get directions through somebody who, you know, I've worked with some fabulous people kind of all over the world over the years, so I have a lot to offer. So these people who come in to do one of my plays, they get to work with me and get some of that experience as an actor. Then they get to influence the people that see their performance. And then what the audience gets from that through them sort of comes back to me. So not that it's two-dimensional to just be an actor, and that's a fabulous thing. But if you are, you know, if you wrote the piece, but you're directing the piece and you're teaching the people and you're presenting the whole thing to the audience and you're kind of responsible for that, then you look at the whole impact you're having on different levels on different amounts of people, and that's very satisfying. So watching my people enjoy themselves because I created an opportunity for them that also echoes off into the audience that happens to see what they do, that is probably the very best thing. Because, again, when I got to teach and direct a little tiny bit at the Cocteau, But the Bachman Players, which has a very limited amount of it can do, because I really kind of am the bottleneck for everything. Mm-hmm. But I write, I teach, I direct, and I act. So the complete experience and seeing how that comes out, that is, like, the I think, the very best thing.
How many people are in the group total, or does it vary?
It absolutely varies. We have some people who come and they, you know, we will do the Easton candle lighting and we'll dress up Victorian and we'll go around and sing Christmas carols. I have some people who come and do only that. Then I have people who come and want to be in every play. Then I have people who, you know, will do a historic event and they'll come fire a musket or give a demonstration about something, and that's all they do. So it could be up to 20 people, but it all depends on what we're doing. But they ebb and flow, and my goal is to try to find the spot for everybody. So it's like, if you want to come once a year and sing a song, that's great. If you want to be involved in everything, that's great. I'll try to find. I keep extra costumes and things like that. So I do sort of like everything. I costume people. I write the plays. I make the sandwiches. Jeez. I make the coffee. And again, that's why when we talk about what we're doing and there's a schedule online, there's not really a lot, because everything that happens, I have to stop myself and say, okay, can I take this on without it being a burden or stress? Because it's mostly me. Although I did a project with the Rosebery House at the Phillipsburg Historical Society a few weeks ago, and I let one of the other Bachman players headline that, and he did a really good job. So, Paul, sure, shout out to you. It was quite lovely.
Do you have a favorite part of just performing overall?
Well, when you have the audience, you know, or my people have the audience, and you know that the connection is there. You know that they're really kind of riveted or with it. Whether you're just acting or whether you're responsible for the piece, that's pretty good.
Well, I do ballet.
Okay.
So, yeah, I love when I'm dancing. I can see the audience, and they're all just, like, present, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Everybody's there and watching and enjoying it.
My ballet teacher used to say, play to the balcony, right?
Mm-hmm. The person in the very back
yeah.
row. And then backtracking a little bit, were there any teachers, mentors, or family members who helped nurture your love for expression?
Well, again, Michael Burgoyne, who sort of pulled me out of high school and, you know, didn't pull me up, but he saw I had something, and he made opportunities for me. College was not sort of so much. It was fine. However, at the end of Bennington, I met Polina Klimovitskaya, who was a teacher at the National Shakespeare Conservatory, and she got me there, and she was pretty wonderful. A few teachers at the conservatory, but really the founder of the Cocteau, Eve Adamson, who passed away a few years ago. We had a lovely relationship, and I never thought I was, you know, a first class actor. I was not world class. I'm not Kenneth Branagh. I wouldn't have gotten into the Royal Shakespeare Academy, but I'm fun to work with. I'm creative. I solve problems, and when I was a time at the Cocteau that. I was sort of looking for a little extra meaning. Eve did some things like would have me teach some of her college classes. There was a time we were doing Six Characters in Search of an Author. Actually, we were going to do it in Brazil because someone had come to see the show in New York and wanted that to come open a theater in São Paulo, Brazil. And Eve had to do the Texas Shakespeare Festival, so she couldn't do the Brazil gig. And she asked me to be the field director of that. So she would always do things like, you know, help me assist her classes, assist direct her, occasionally take a show internationally somewhere. And she was a real founder of the off-Broadway movement. And I love her and I'm thankful. But that's one of the reasons, I mean, Eve in particular, I mean, the other actors at the Cocteau were some of the finest artists you could ever hope to work with. And that's part of my drive to want to do what I do and make sure I work with people, because I've been privileged to encounter these people. And if I don't try to share that light in some way, then I think the world's a little smaller for it.
And in today's society, there's a strong push towards careers in STEM, or even now like AI, mm-hmm. often sometimes overshadowing the value of the arts. Why do you think the arts are sometimes seen as less essential, and what role do you believe artistic careers still play in shaping our future?
Now, that's a big question. It's interesting that, you know, I have kind of what just occurred to me is a bit of a historical answer, and this is a paraphrase, so you're going to have to not quote me on it, but John Adams said something like, you know, I study the military, or I study milling, or I study industry so that my sons can study art. Because in the early colonies, it took so much energy to just practically exist that you had to focus on practical things. There wasn't much room for creativity in art. You know, so I understand that there's a drive to be practical. However, my experience in life is that they do feed each other. I think we all know if we think through, we can think of people who are engineers or mathematically driven and they take ballet or they play an instrument or they do a thing. My livelihood has always been technology, but I've done technology and theater side by side my entire life. And the people that work with me at the Everett Collection, my agency, my best friends, some of them, they complain when I'm not doing a creative project. They say, we can tell you're not doing a creative project because you're not paying attention and you're not as good to work with. You know, so they really kind of, they blend each other. They make us stronger. It is a shame that young people might have less opportunity to encounter the arts because these things don't happen sort of, I don't want to say naturally, but if someone's got a light for something, if that could be their true purpose or could really enhance their lives, thus helping them enhance the lives of other people, if they could be their true selves by participating in art and they're going to have less opportunity to encounter that, that's a shame. And then I think that to solve some problems that we have, I think we need imagination and we need compassion and we need empathy. And I think the arts augments all of those. And I'm not sure that, I think Einstein played the violin. You know, I think we're going to be a smaller world with less of that.
Well, because I feel like I'm like a junior right now. So I'm looking at like college and whatever, what the next steps are. And I feel like often it's presented as like an either or choice when the reality is that they do go hand in hand and like piggyback off each other. And which I think is a very important
message. And you've seen that in your experience, right? Uh-huh. You're taking ballet, but you're also pursuing other things. Mm-hmm. And you know, you probably get tired at rehearsal or whatever. But, you know, there's this whole expansive part of your brain that when you're trying to solve another problem, the experience you've had with ballet will augment it and help you.
It crosses over, yeah. What do you think the significance of history or historical figures plays in the Lehigh Valley specifically?
What role does it play? Well, there's a lot of it. And this is sort of a cheap answer, but I really enjoyed reading the Harry Potter books, and there was like seven of them, and it was like one to one. But then they were done, and you're like, oh, now that thing is done. The thing about following the story of history is it never is done. It is never done. There is no way that I could keep up with, like, even the newspapers of the day, of the times that I'm interested in. Never mind the letters, you know, never mind the books, never mind the autobiographies, the digging and the finding. So you can just go sort of so far. And the Lehigh Valley just happens, I mean, every place has a lot. And I've been very lucky because once I decided I was going to get into history here, I sort of made friends with some folks from the Lenape Nation of Pennsylvania were kind of housed out of the Bachman, their cultural center. Here's another plug, by the way. Their cultural center is open most Saturdays at the bottom level of the Bachman House. But I did a project with them called the Walking Purchase Healing Journey, where some folks from the nation and Bachman players actually recreated what was called the Walking Purchase, which is how the land that we're on was taken away from the Lenape. Mm-hmm. But my idea was, let me start as far back as I can, and then go into the founding of Easton, which Benjamin Franklin was like, he was involved in the founding, but he came and saved the Lehigh Valley in 1755. There's a story people don't know. Outbreak of the French and Indian War, the guy who founded Easton, William Parsons, at the bequest of the Penns, was very good friends with Franklin. And at the outbreak of the war, Easton was in really bad shape because suddenly the Blue Mountains, the Delaware Water Gap, that was now the frontier. And raiding parties were coming across and burning farms, and there are all these refugees. And Parsons writes to Franklin and says, if we don't get help, we're going to have to abandon Easton. And then Franklin came here. He said, be of good courage. Your friends will never desert you. And he showed up. There are just all these stories. The Walking Purchase it's not a fabulous story, but it's so worth knowing. Franklin coming here to save the Lehigh Valley. He was in Easton for a week at Christmas of 1755. People just don't know this stuff. So it's both exploring it and learning it and then sharing it at the same time. So I think there's history really anywhere, but it's easy in the Lehigh Valley because Easton was like, I read the Declaration at Heritage Day. I've done it for 12 years maybe.
I went last year.
What?
I went to
Oh,
that
you did?
Last year,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, great. I mean, you know, and that's like because it was one of the three places that it was read. Mm-hmm. So you get to recreate all that. So it's so available. And that's July 11th, by the way, this year, everybody. So.
Okay, well, on that note, then, that's a wrap for today's episode of Teen Connect. Thank you so much for being here and sharing your story. You can learn more about the Bachman Players at www.bachman.com. And of course, thank you all for tuning in to Teen Connect on WDIY 88.1. Be sure to listen in next time as we keep exploring the issues and ideas that matter most to young people today. Until then, take care and stay connected.